I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The revolution in electric vehicles depends on batteries, and batteries depend on what are called rare minerals, things like lithium, cobalt, nickel, manganese. They're mined in China, the Republic of the Congo, Chile, Australia, even Russia. Car companies are betting big on e-vehicles, increasing the demand for better and more batteries. So what does it take to dig those minerals out of the earth and process them to power electric cars and trucks? Our guest, Eric Lipton, has been looking into the impact of this kind of mining on the environment and the humans who do this work, including children. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. And Eric Lipton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The future of electric vehicles really depends on battery technology. Is there a supply to meet the demand?
No, there's not sufficient supply, and it is going to be a fascinating and challenging thing to watch play out. You just have to look at the supply chain challenges that we've had in the past couple of years during the pandemic with chips that were needed for cars. And, you know, the supply chain for an electric vehicle is radically different than that for a conventional car. You need something like 440 pounds of various metals and minerals for an electric car compared to about 72 pounds, not including the steel itself, but the outside of the steel for making the car. And so the whole geopolitics of oil versus metals is radically different. And we're entering a whole new era of new challenges associated with getting the metals and minerals that are needed to build all of these electric vehicles that in order to achieve the plans that Biden and others have for increasing EVs on the road in the United States and around the world.
I mentioned some of those rare minerals and also some of those countries as well, China, the Republic of the Congo, Chile, Australia, Russia. Are they the sort of main players when it comes to rare minerals for these batteries?
Yeah, and it's not just rare minerals. It's the term, a broader term that is often used is critical minerals, and rare minerals is a subset of critical minerals. And so Congo is supplies 70% of the cobalt in the world, just one country. And cobalt is right now an essential ingredient in most electric vehicle batteries. It has an energy density that allows them to go at a longer range. And so Congo is really important, and lithium comes mostly from Australia and places like Chile and Argentina. And nickel comes from Russia and Indonesia for the most part, and also some in Canada. But it's so interesting because it's so different from the map that you look at when you look at, well, where does oil come from?
Right.
The metals come from totally different places.
Well, you talk about 70% of the cobalt coming from Congo. What is it like to get cobalt essentially out of the ground in Congo? What does that industry look like?
The United States used to have a very large presence in Congo. It owned one of the world's largest cobalt and copper mines through a Freeport-McMoRan, Arizona-based miner. During the Obama administration, Freeport-McMoRan sold that mine. It's the second largest cobalt mine in the world to a Chinese-funded Chinese company. China Moly. And so right now, the Chinese have a dominant position in Congo in terms of they control the majority of the mines. And the other big player is a company called Glencore, which is a Swiss mining company. But there's all kinds of complications in Congo. There's corruption. And outside of the big mines, it's the industrial mines, there's a lot of children and adults who are involved in what's called artisanal mining, in which they are simply collecting these rocks of copper and cobalt that are on the side of the road and selling them on a black market. And that's where you get the human rights concerns, is because not only are these metals coming from industrial scale mines, but they're also coming from the artisanal mining trade, which is children and adults who are simply collecting it to make a living.
And how much then of this critical minerals market, as you describe it, is really controlled by China? You mentioned this company, a China-run company in Congo.
Well, not only does China have a corner on the market for the raw materials, but even more so, almost all of the raw materials then go to China for processing. And so even if you're mining, for example, lithium in the United States, and very little lithium is produced in the United States, it will go to China to be processed before it comes back to the United States to be put into batteries, because almost all of the processing is there. And China has just invested the capital to build the infrastructure around the battery marketplace in a way that the United States did not. I mean, look at where the mask, you know, the mask that we needed during COVID came from. Most of them came from China, and we were without manufacturing base. This is something that the Biden administration now realizes, and it's left the United States extremely vulnerable. And there are hundreds of millions of dollars of capital now going into the battery manufacturing to try to bring the United States into a competitive place on this whole market, both in terms of the raw materials and the processing.
And how quickly can that be scaled up, do you think?
It is one of the biggest manufacturing spends in modern American history. I mean, Ford, GM, Chrysler, all are spending, you know, massive amounts of money. I mean, they're radically turning their manufacturing systems. And it's happening very quickly. And the United States government is putting billions of dollars to back that up in terms of providing loans and also building EV infrastructure in terms of charging capacity in the United States. But still, it's going to take years. And the United States is very far behind China in the battery manufacturing, in the raw materials, in the processing. We are at a massive competitive disadvantage compared to where the United States was at the birth of the automobile.
You had mentioned Russia, and that's where nickel is mined. Is that correct?
Yeah, Russia is one of the world's major sources of nickel. And you look at the nickel market, it's gone completely crazy in the last month.
I bet.
Because Russia is such an important supplier of nickel. And nickel is a vital ingredient, along with cobalt and lithium, in most batteries. So it's another supply chain shock that is going to affect, you know, the global markets.
You mentioned the fact that auto companies and other and the U.S. government is investing in battery technology. Is that just for cars and trucks and charging stations, or is it even beyond that?
It's beyond that because, you know, batteries are essential as well for renewable energy in general, for solar and wind, because they if you want to really rely on solar and wind, you're going to need to have off-peak nighttime and when there's no wind. And so it means you're going to need to have batteries to take power that's being produced during the day and use it at night. So you're going to need to have massive battery infrastructure that's associated with renewable energy. And so there's also a lot of money being spent on developing more efficient, you know, higher energy capacity, longer lasting, faster charging batteries for renewable energy. The battery industry is just a giant space of innovation and capital spend right now that's going to determine the competitive position of the United States in this whole revolution that we're going through.
My understanding is that Tesla gets its minerals, I guess, directly. It doesn't have relying on a supply chain that other companies rely on. What do we need to know about that?
I mean, Tesla and, you know, Elon Musk is irascible but brilliant, and he in this case is brilliant again in that he's the only major United States auto manufacturer that goes directly to the mines and buys the minerals, and so therefore he has worked out supply contracts that are much less vulnerable to disruption. And so he is actually directly contracting with mines in places like New Caledonia in the South Pacific and other places all over the world, including the United States, to buy the metals, whereas all the other automakers rely on contractors who then are suppliers. And so it just is they don't have nearly as much control or assurance that they're going to get the metals they need. And there is about to be a metals war globally, not a fighting war, military war, but an economic war over access to these metals, because there are way too many commitments that have been made to build batteries and not nearly enough metals that are coming out of the ground. And the prices are already surging for lithium and for cobalt and for nickel because there's not enough of them to meet all of these goals that everyone has set to transition to EVs.
Here's a related question from John, one of our listeners, wondering whether you think that the agenda to get more EVs on the road was premature because there's not because of these supply chain problems that you're talking about.
It's a good question, but the reality is that the markets move markets, and supply and demand is the thing that's, for example, going to create the innovation in batteries. One of the things that's going on, and we just did a story, my colleague Jack Ewing and I, about how one of the things that the U.S. automakers are doing, recognizing these supply chain problems, is they're quickly looking for alternative chemistries in their batteries. Mm-hmm. to try to expand the number of metals and minerals that they can use in their batteries, including some that are quite common, like magnesium, other ingredients. And so, but innovation is going to drive, you know, and demand is going to drive more supply. And now it's going to take a number of years to build the supply, because you need capital to go in and tell the mining companies, here's, you know, X billion dollars, build a new mine. But it, you know, until you have the demand, you're not going to have the supply. So I understand the question. It seems like a good one, but it's simply waiting was not going to answer it. There just has to be a transitional period in which demand overwhelms supply, and then supply will catch up with demand.
A lot of people interested in electric vehicles are doing it because they think it's good for the climate. When you look at what it takes to get these critical minerals out of the ground, what are the environmental costs there?
There are definitely, you know, environmental consequences, and they, in some cases, are more intense than, you know, manufacturing a combustion engine car. In Indonesia, there's been a lot of concern about water pollution and other pollution from the nickel mines, which are particularly dirty in how they produce the nickel that's needed for it. Nickel is probably the dirtiest of all of the metals that is vital for EVs, and both in Russia, there's been some terrible environmental consequences from nickel mining. And, you know, that said, the automakers are very conscious of the fact that they can't be producing a dirty electric vehicle. And so they are demanding that the mines that they get their supplies from try to meet tighter environmental standards. And my colleague Hannah Beach did a story out of New Caledonia in South Pacific about the work that Tesla's doing to try to improve the environmental standards of the nickel production there. Because the automakers almost have become the global environmental regulators, because if they realize that they can't be selling to this California liberal a dirty car that's killing people from pollution, and that's not going to last very long. So they themselves are demanding. And so while it's true that there are environmental consequences from this mining, there is a move to try to limit them. But you will never – mining is always inherently dirty. There's no way to mine without disrupting the earth and causing some environmental consequences. But there is an effort to try to minimize it.
A minute before we have to say goodbye, are there these minerals, are they in the United States? Could they be mined in this country?
There's a massive amount of lithium, more lithium than we could ever need in the United States, but almost none is currently produced. And so lithium, we could supply all of our needs, but there is capital that is rapidly moving into that space, because lithium, of all the metals needed, is probably in shortest supply for EVs right now. There's not much nickel in the United States. There's almost no cobalt, but there is a lot of magnesium. So, I mean, yeah, the short answer is there are some metals here, but there's, proportionately speaking, there's a lot more oil in the United States relative to the oil needed for cars than there are the metals needed for EVs. So the United States is going to have to look elsewhere in the world. And there's going to be a lot of geopolitical pressure on producing those metals and minerals in the next couple of decades.
Well, Eric Lipton, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He is investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he has been covering what it takes to get some of these minerals out of the ground to power the electric vehicles. Coming up on Radio Times, we've got two automotive journalists who are going to be joining us to talk about what we all need to know about electric vehicles. And you can join us. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last year, electric cars were less than 10% of sales in the U.S., but higher gas prices at the pump, more range and EV models to choose from, as well as concerns about climate have driven up demand. Problem now is long wait lists. Car manufacturers haven't been able to keep up with the surge in demand, and there's a global shortage of parts, most notably for semiconductors and, as we just heard, batteries. President Biden wants half of car sales in 2030 to be electric, and the administration has invested $5 billion to build EV charging stations across the country. We were just talking with New York Times reporter Eric Lipton about mining minerals for batteries. We focus now on the newest electric vehicles, the latest battery technology, and where our electric infrastructure stands. And we've got two automotive journalists, John Volker, and Nikki Gordon Bloomfield. John Volker is contributing editor for Car and Driver, former editor of Green Car Reports. John Volker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us, Nikki Gordon Bloomfield, as I mentioned, founder and lead presenter of Transport Evolve. And that's a YouTube channel dedicated to the world of cleaner, greener, safer, and smarter transportation. Nikki Gordon Bloomfield, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here, and it's good to have a reunion with my former mentor and friend, John.
Yes, morning, I understand. You know each other and have worked together. Let me just toss out a headline I saw. I'm kind of summarizing it here when it comes to electric vehicles. And perhaps, Nikki, I'll toss this to you, that it's kind of the best of times, but also the worst of times. Does that seem to sum it up?
Well, look, I think one of the things that we need to be careful of here is when we're discussing parts shortages, when we're discussing the fact that the automotive industry right now is struggling to keep up with demand for EVs. The reality is the automotive industry is struggling to keep up with production of anything right now. We're seeing major automakers shutter plants temporarily while they wait for their parts supply chains to be sorted out. It's been made worse by the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And I think it's very interesting to see how different automakers are prioritizing electric vehicle production. We're seeing it in the US. Ford has shuttered some of its F-150 production facilities, but is continuing to produce the F-150 Lightning, a pickup truck that it's promised now for about a year. And which has, you know, the potential to really change the pickup truck world. It's the first kind of work-oriented electric pickup truck to come to market. Now, in terms of is it the best of times and the worst of times, yes. If you want to buy an EV today and you want to buy one now, you're going to find it difficult to find a vehicle nearby to you, especially if you live in a large metropolitan area, that is going to suit your needs because somebody else is going to be wanting to buy it and they're going to be in a bidding war with you. But when it comes to the models available, I think we are in the most diverse market for electric vehicles that we've ever seen. We're seeing new cars coming to market that offer better range, better performance, and better bang for your buck.
Well, and I want to pick up on all that, but John, I want to get you in on the conversation and talk about where you see this demand coming from. And maybe it is everything from sort of coming together from climate to the cost of what it is today. I think I heard this morning it's something like $4 and something cents to, you know, for a gallon of gas to put in your gas-powered vehicle. How do you understand this growing demand?
Well, I have to say that we are much further along the greater public adopting electric cars curve now, even than 18 months ago. You can sort of, if you live in this world, as Nikki and I do, you feel it. Just there's more public interest. And I would attribute it, sure, temporarily this month maybe, to gas prices. Although 90% of Americans have no idea what they pay for a kilowatt hour. So most
that is
of the
true.
Charging of an EV which is done at home, they have no idea what it costs. So they're not really doing the math in a sort of an informed way as yet. But I think one of the drivers is that electric cars now have made such incredible progress over the last decade. If you think about 2011, which was the first model year, you had a battery electric vehicle, the Nissan Leaf, that had 74 miles of range, and it was a compact hatchback. Fast forward a decade, and you have one of the Detroit makers introducing an electric full-sized pickup truck, which is this massive category for sales, millions of them sold every year in the U.S., with 250, 300 miles of range. And all of a sudden, that's a vehicle where someone says, right, I'm never going to buy a compact hatchback. That's not what I drive. But a pickup truck, I understand that. It looks like a regular pickup truck. It doesn't look peculiar. And not only does it have the range that I think I need, but it has these other things in it that a gasoline car can't do. The whole power out, or bidirectional charging as it's called, to let you power electric stuff, including your household in a blackout, in certain circumstances. all of a sudden people are starting to see electric cars as comparable to the gasoline alternatives, for which the price has spiked, obviously. But even more, if they know someone who has an electric car, and statistically it's most likely to be a Tesla, or maybe they got a ride, or maybe they heard the story about that person driving that electric car cross country, all of a sudden, electric cars are much more real and people are starting to consider them, whereas they wouldn't if it was just one small, very low range electric car. Think about that progress over the past 10 years. Think about where we may be in the next 10 years. And remember that the auto industry operates on very long product cycles, 5 to 7 years. So already the car makers are thinking about what's coming in 2028. I think those vehicles will be very exciting, will be further along the adoption curve, and with luck, a lot of the supply chain issues will have been resolved.
Well, let me pick up on several things, and even this issue of range, Nikki, when, as we heard from John, you know, when the Nissan Leaf came out, it had 74 miles, you know, people would not stand for that now. But I think there's this notion that, you know, I need to get 450 miles in my electric vehicle, or it's, you know, I can't live with that. How should we think about range, and how, in fact, do we actually live with our vehicles?
I think the really important thing here is to grasp a concept which is amusing, but also real world. We've reached a point where electric vehicles, the majority of them on the market today, there are a few exceptions, will happily drive 2 or 3 hours before you need to stop. And that is about the average comfort distance that most people who are consuming liquid and food at a normal person rate.
You're talking about bathroom stops, right?
Can comfortably travel. Yeah, can comfortably travel before needing to visit a bathroom. And, you know, some of the cars that are coming to market right now, Kia and Hyundai, they are sibling companies. They have jointly developed a platform on which the EV6, the Kia EV6, and the Hyundai Ioniq 5 are based. And these two cars have 800 volt rapid charging. Now, that doesn't mean squat to most people. Right. Until you say, it means that you can visit a rest stop, you can go grab a coffee, you can grab a quick bite to eat, and when you return to your car has enough charge in it for you to continue your journey. I have been driving electric vehicles since 2006. And you could tell from my accent, I'm British by birth, and I drove a lot in the UK with short-range EVs. When I moved over to the US, my first electric car here was a Nissan Leaf. Now, I drive cars with 200-plus miles of range, and it is night and day.
Because you got that extra mileage. Obviously,
yeah, exactly.
With the car that you have now. Let me just pick up on something, and John, I'll toss it to you, which having to do with then charging stations, with the infrastructure. I mentioned that the Biden administration wants to invest something like $5 billion in putting in charging stations across the country. My understanding that there's something like 150,000 gas stations in the United States. How many charging stations do we need to do to build in order to keep up with this growing demand?
This is a wonderful question. And I, in lots of talks over the years, Nikki and I and some of our colleagues have probably decided that the charging aspect of EVs is the most misunderstood one at the moment. We have 150,000 gas stations in the US because you don't have a gas pump near your property, in your garage, wherever you park. And the biggest misconception, I think, is that because people don't have a model, you know, your closest model for plugging something in at night is your cell phone. At least we have that. But of the households in the US that can afford to buy a new car with an average transaction price now, amazingly, of $46,000, people with the shortages and everything, cars have gotten really expensive. So of the households that have the income to buy a new car, and of the EVs that we will see on the road 5 years hence, most of them haven't yet been sold. The sales are going to go up greatly. Of those households, Four out of five already have dedicated off-street parking with electricity nearby somewhere. And so the bulk of charging for the EVs that are going to be sold in the near term is going to be done at home, probably overnight, and secondarily at work for those people who drive a place and park. Charging at work is sort of the overlooked one. But electric car owners quickly learn that you don't think about public charging because you plug in at night and you come out with a full battery, full tank. Now, this is not to deny the really complicated problems of people who live in apartments or what have you, or street park.
Sure, sure. In fact, let me just toss in a question from John, who says, I live in the city. I don't have a garage. How would I charge an EV, an extension cord out onto the street? Go ahead, John Volker.
Yeah, it's right now it's a challenge. And unfortunately, the U.S. is behind other places.
I have friends
who live in London who have been sending me pictures of curbside charging stations, which are rapidly proliferating all over the city. The conditions for owning a car in capitals are different all over the place. It is a challenge. One of the alternatives for John is a plug-in hybrid, which is to say a vehicle that has some battery range so that when you can charge, you plug it in and drive electrically, but you also have a gasoline engine as a backup.
And I would love to jump in there, Nikki.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry for that. I would like to add, I've got two people who work at the channel, our animator and our video editor. Both of them live in rented accommodation and both have a plug-in hybrid. They both own Chevrolet Volts, and that's because they do struggle. But I think something that is really important when people think about charging infrastructure, especially in urban environments, is, oh, how are we going to pay for all of these charging stations to be rolled out? And the reality is, you go to any major city in the US today, and there's charging infrastructure staring you right in the face. I'll explain. Over the last 10, 20 years in some more progressive cities, we've seen street lamps, street furniture change from incandescent and high halogen bulbs to much more ultra-efficient LED light bulbs. And cities and municipalities have done that as a cost-saving measure because it costs them a lot less money to light the street with LED lights than it does with halogens. They have a longer lifespan. They require less maintenance. And so these cities have turned from using halogen and incandescent lights to using LEDs. But the underlying electrical infrastructure that carries the power to the light poles hasn't changed. It's still capable of carrying the high current draw that those original lights had before they were turned to LEDs. And what we're seeing in certain European countries is street furniture being turned into charging outlets.
Wow.
They put a charging outlet on the bottom of a light post. And imagine a future where you have that. You have a light post and you have a charging station built right in. We have the technology today to identify who that person is. In some cities even, there's buy-in from the local utility. So you type in a PIN code and it knows that PIN code is your electricity account with a local utility, and your utility bills you for the electricity that your car consumes from the street lamp at the side of the street.
Well, it does raise a question, John. Why can't we do that in the United States? I mean, that seems so clever, and when you think about it, so available.
It's one of those questions where you have lots and lots of players who have to come together. And we have not had, over the last 10 years, strong national policy to provide slower charging of that sort, of the lamppost or overnight charging, to people who do not have their own place to park.
Sure.
I want to sort of expand on the charging issue, though, because there are really two kinds of charging. One is this slower charging, technically it's called level two, that takes a few hours or several hours, depending on your car, to refill. The other one is what's called fast charging. These are essentially along highways or at the intersections of really major trunk roads. These are the charging stations, and Nikki talked about it earlier, where when you're on a longer trip than your electric car's range, you stop off, you plug in the car and walk away, get your coffee, make your pit stop, spend time jabbing at your phone, and in some length of time, from 15 to 30 minutes, your car is recharged for another 2 or 3 hours of travel. Those are, in some ways, I think, more important to allow electric cars to do the longer trips. And the longer range the cars get, 300 miles, there's now one with 500 miles.
Wow.
The less you need those. But the problem with all of these charging stations is people don't know they're there. Everybody knows what a gas station looks like. Even if you don't drive, you can sort of say, right, that's a gas station over there. Charging equipment is smaller. Often it's in obscure places, and it's not signposted on highways. People just don't know what's already out there. Tens of thousands of charging stations available that they just look through or have never become aware of.
We're almost having a break here, but John, doesn't that stuff show up on people's screens in their electric cars so that at least they know where they are, correct?
Indeed, to a varying degree. Not every maker is quite as good as Tesla, which simply routes you among its charging stations and even tells you how long to stay there based on the route you're doing. Mm-hmm. But it's also a matter of people sort of subconsciously knowing they're out there before they buy an EV. Because I hear a lot, I imagine, Nikki, you do too, I'd buy an EV, but there's no charging stations out there. And then you sit down and you say, oh, look, in a 5-mile radius of where you work, there are actually 14.
Hmm.
And people are like, I've never seen them. This is the problem, is that charging stations are just smaller. And so if people aren't aware, they think they're not there, and that's a hurdle by itself.
And we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about electric vehicles today on Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests. They are automotive journalists about electric vehicles. John Volker, contributing editor for Car and Driver. Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield, founder and lead presenter for Transport Evolve. That's a YouTube channel about the world of cleaner, greener, safer, smarter transportation. Let me get Chas to join our conversation. And Chas, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. I believe.
Good morning, Marty.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Of course.
I just wanted to mention my personal experience. I just bought an electric vehicle in December. It's a BMW i3 with a range extender. So for me, we live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and we have only street parking. So I drape a cord out and the little surge protector or conditioner, if you will, that I plug into a wall outlet, the box for it, I just sit on the tire.
And it
works? I drape the cord out across the street, and nobody is the wiser. Nobody has any issues with it.
And you're pleased, Chas?
I'm really pleased with it. I think the scariest thing for me was, again, not understanding where charging stations were, the daily load of driving the car, and the concept that on many of these vehicles, what you see is like a countdown of miles. Like I'll have a 70-mile range on the battery, and then it will drop down to a 60-mile range, and that's dependent on your driving style, things like hills. And I think people are used to seeing a regular gas gauge, you know, of a full to empty, and they don't really think about it because it's not as specific in detail. So they might not be paying attention unless someone is doing the math, right? Like you guys were just talking about, people don't really know how much a kilowatt hour gets you. I think that was the biggest transition. And a lot of the charging stations, what I've noticed, and I've driven the car all over the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York area, is that sometimes it is a little bit of a, you know, undercover secret mission to attempt to find where a charging station is. Right. And then when you arrive at it, to try to figure out what private company runs it. Do I need to download their app? Do I need to start a membership? Do I, you know, what do I need to do to use it? I actually find using things like Google Maps and searching generally for chargers is easiest. And then there's the fear of finding a charger that has the right adapter for you, and do those apps tell you what? And I think from, you know, December until now, and it's only been a few months, I feel completely comfortable with it. But the first, you know, December, January was very daunting to kind of figure out this completely new technology, and so much of it being so privatized and not standardized.
I hear you.
I think was another thing.
Thank you
for having me on.
Absolutely. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me just, Nikki, pick up on something, even from Chas saying that she bought a BMW, and I wonder, when you look at electric cars, and they run the gamut. There's a Kia, you mentioned Tesla, of course. There's the, you know, Ford and Chevy. All the car companies are getting in on the action. Besides the price, the cost, some of the bells and whistles, what is different about their technology, or is it pretty much the same?
I mean, all electric cars operate in a fairly similar way. They all have, you know, your standard controls that you'd find in most vehicles. They're going to have, obviously, they mostly differ in the way that you can drive. Some of them will have a simulated engine brake. So when you lift off the throttle, the car will start to slow down. Some of them don't. They'll just glide. And some allow you to select that. Now, that glide versus slowing down, when you have the car slow down, when you lift your foot off the gas pedal, mm-hmm. or in this case, the accelerator pedal, you engage what's known as regenerative braking, so you can recapture some of that energy and put it back into the battery pack. But most electric cars do all have a very, very familiar driving experience. Once you've driven one, you generally feel fairly comfortable driving them all. But I do want to just circle back on something that Chas said, and that is, you know, how do you find the charging stations? How do you know what the charging station has and whether it's compatible with your car? There are a couple of great apps out there that you can get for your smartphone. One that I like is run by a friend of mine in here in Portland. It's called Chargeway, and it aims to demystify electric fuel rather than using technical terms that a lot of people will be unfamiliar with and won't know. It relies on a number and coloring system, and it says, okay, when you buy this car, your car has a metaphorical color that goes with the charging inlet, and it has a range of charge speeds that it can operate at. The higher the number, the more quickly the car will be able to charge. And when you get the app, you put in the car you have, it will then tell you what charging stations near to you are compatible with your car. And it will only show you charging stations that are compatible with your car. But it will also allow you to pick the one with the highest number if you are in a hurry. You can go to the number 7. If your car can charge at a green 7, you can go to a green 7 and charge up quickly. If you only want to charge more slowly, you can choose a smaller number. And it really helps. And I think that the discussion of electric fuel, picking up something that John said, is kind of the missing piece right now. A lot of auto dealerships don't understand electric cars. They don't understand talking about filling up because they've never had to discuss with people how to fill up with gas. It's kind of become a thing. Right, exactly. And so there's a lot of work being done in the background. The National Auto Dealers Association has just made a massive push on electric vehicle training. And I think that is something that we need to see dealerships doing before a lot of people are going to feel more comfortable buying cars.
Well, let me, I'm looking at my screen here. We got a lot of questions and comments. And John, I'll pick a couple here, several of them about batteries. One, Elaine saying, could batteries be standardized for exchange? Dean wants to know about how to recycle or even reclaim some of the metals in some of the batteries that are obviously powering these electric vehicles. Is there, I talked a little bit with Eric Lipton about what it takes to, you know, get the minerals to create these batteries. But obviously battery technology is so key to the future of electric cars. What do people need to know, and where's that going?
So a couple of questions there, both of them very good. Recycling battery packs at the end of their lives will definitely be a part of the minerals supply for electric cars in future. Mm-hmm. Right now, there aren't a lot of electric cars out there, and most of them are not yet at end of life. So that's a thing that is attracting a lot of venture capital right now. Tesla's former chief technology officer for about 4 years now has run a company devoted exclusively to getting old EV battery packs, breaking them down, and selling the resulting minerals. The question of what happens to battery packs after electric car use, we don't really have enough data because there haven't been enough electric cars since 2011 that have reached the ends of their lives. But there will be a little bit of battery degradation. This is a question we get a lot. And we're starting to see automakers say, we will warrant against loss of capacity below a certain level after 10 years or something like that. So that's one thing to look at as you buy an electric car. What is the warranty on the battery? As for battery swapping, interesting question. There have been some experiments. The challenge is simply that the battery is such a structural component of the vehicle. And depending on whether it's a pickup truck or a low-slung sports sedan, it's going to be shaped differently. It's an integral part of the crash structure. And automakers are very unlikely to say, right, we're adopting a single 1,000-pound battery with these dimensions for everything that we offer. The best model for battery swapping is the forklift industry. And I'm personally not aware of any cases where the forklift industry has innovated to a degree that automakers pick up on it. The one usage for passenger vehicles that may make sense is for ride sharing or taxis or what have you. Very high mile vehicles where turnaround is incredibly quick. But that's a much easier thing to do in limited areas than to try to provide battery swapping for all the passenger vehicles in the U.S.
Yeah, I hear. Here's a comment from Edward, and Nikki, I'll toss this to you. He says, how much are they going to cost? How much are they going to cost if a regular car costs $46,000? Are you kidding me? It sounds like someone isn't saying it's too much. Sorry, I won't be able to afford one. And I think picking up on that, we are talking about an expensive car. I don't know what a gas powered car costs these days, but this is a lot of money. And when you look at the savings on not filling up at the gas pump, is it affordable? Does it make sense economically?
It depends. Now, before we talk about specific examples of lower cost cars, I just want to reiterate something. We're talking about the average new price of your average new car,
right,
being, you know, in that $40,000 mark. That doesn't mean there are not more affordable cars on the market today. Part of that is automakers shaping the market to produce higher end models because they can upsell you on it. The dealers can upsell you on it. The dealers tend to buy in more expensive models because they can make more profit on it. The car companies make more profit on it than the lower end models. The technology in today's cars has pushed the price of every car up. That is because of things like the safety systems that keep us safe on the roads, whether it's lane keep assist or whether it's, you know, radar assisted cruise control. And I think it's important to acknowledge that every car price, as John said, has gone up. But there are some cars on the market now that are actually much more affordable. I'll give you an example. Okay. The entry-level Nissan Leaf. It's a car that's been around, the Nissan Leaf as a brand has been around now for, or as a model, sorry, has been around for more than a decade. The current generation Nissan Leaf was introduced in 2017. You can get an entry-level version for $27,400. That's the manufacturer's suggested retail price. I believe that's before any destination or delivery fees. If you are somebody who pays tax and you have a taxable income, you can claim a federal tax rebate on some EVs on sale, most EVs on sale today, at the end of the year when you do your taxes. So if you are eligible for the federal tax incentive, the federal tax credit for EVs, that Nissan Leaf, the effective sticker price of that can be as low as just under $21,000. That is a much more affordable proposition for some people than, you know, buying a new gas car and then having to pay gas and then having to pay the servicing costs. Servicing costs for EVs are much lower. Obviously, the cost to charge at home is negligible to most people. It's only when you're out and about and you're making massive long distance trips that the cost tends to be a little more, because charging networks have to have overheads, and you're not having any overheads when you charge at home. So there are a range of options available. You can go on a used car site now and you can pick up used cars like a Nissan Leaf, a Chevrolet Bolt, or a Kia Soul, anything like that. You can pick those up from anywhere as low. Nissan Leafs I've seen from $6,000 upwards. Chevrolet Bolts are currently starting at about $12,000, $13,000, $14,000. I do want to apologize. I don't know if you can hear my rooster
screaming in the background. If that was a rooster or what that was, but that's
yes,
okay.
I have a small holding in the Oregon countryside.
Okay. Nikki,
cost can be very effective.
Only because I'm looking at the clock here. And let me just add, I know in New Jersey, because we have a lot of listeners in New Jersey, you get some kind of dispensation when it comes to sales tax buying electric vehicles. But let me toss something to you, John, that you wrote about why electric vehicles accelerate so quickly. I was actually in one recently, and and my head went back to the back of the car, you know, the back of the seat, I should say, when the driver hit the gas.
Modern gasoline cars, in order to comply with fuel economy regulations, have smaller engines, and they're computer controlled to run those engines at their most efficient level. And they have transmissions that have way more gears. If you haven't looked at cars lately, you may be unaware that the average auto now has an 8, 9, or 10 speed automatic transmission, which is a lot. So what that means on the road, if you're behind the wheel, is that when you suddenly need to accelerate, the engine has to rev up and the transmission has to shift down several times, which creates a delay before you get that surge of speed on your on-ramp or whatever. Electric cars have none of that. An electric motor can produce its maximum power instantly from rest. And so the practical effect of that is you end up winning a lot of stoplight Grand Prix. And no matter what kind of a driver you are, the ability to accelerate smartly away from a stoplight and perhaps surprise the person next to you is almost always a good thing. And they're simply calmer and smoother to drive, especially if you use the regenerative braking that you talked about. One of the things that people don't realize until they get behind the wheel of an electric car is that they're just nicer to drive.
Because they're what, quieter, smoother, whatever?
All of the above. Yeah.
And simpler as well, a lot simpler.
Lots of screens though, right? Well, you know what? We got to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. John Volker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's contributing editor for Car and Driver. Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And thanks for the rooster crowing in the backyard. We always like ambient sounds there. She's founder and lead presenter of Transport Evolve. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.